We had a rainy November, didn't we? As the rain was falling a couple of weeks ago, I looked out at our swamp, and we had more water standing in our yard than we did during Hurricane Florence. And given that we had almost as much rain over those few days as we did in the bigger storm, I shouldn't have been surprised. And it was already saturated ground, too. But it still wasn't the catastrophic rain they had not all that far east of here. The real problem from that amount of flooding isn't just the floodwaters themselves. It's what comes next. And the North Carolina Baptists have and will continue to have disaster relief crews busily at work for the next 2 to 3 years, getting life restored to where it was before Florence rolled through in those areas. It'll take that long because the cleanup work is hard. You've got to go into these homes and demo and replace everything. Everything from the ground up to above wherever the final water line was. And you have to do all that because of the threat of mold. Now, mold is nasty stuff. Individual mold spores are smaller than the naked eye can see, but they can take hold of an area of your house and grow and spread until they are collectively a big problem. Mold doesn't just come from storms, though. Sometimes folks have a water leak somewhere they didn't know about for a while. They got that cleaned up, but don't realize the full extent of where the water had spread its moisture. Mold can take hold in those times and grow in secret for months or even years. It remains a secret until you start noticing that your health, it's not as good as it used to be. And there's nothing specific that served as a tip-off, just a trend. But the trend continues and worsens until you start looking for causes beyond the normal range of what could be wrong. That's when you finally find the mold. And cleaning up mold like that, it's hard work. It takes intentionality and dedication over a long period of time. It usually winds up being destructive to other parts of the house as well as you work to make sure it is completely eliminated. And in short, it's nasty stuff. It can hamper our journeys through life the same way some different things can hamper our journeys after Jesus. Well, this morning finds us in the final part of our series, Pursue, Chasing God in a Godless World. Now, the big idea for this journey has been that if you're someone who would say, yes, I'm a follower of Jesus, things are a little tougher for you than they used to be, aren't they? The culture's changing around us, some days faster than we can keep up. Furthermore, it's changing in ways that aren't in our favor. As we talked about a couple of weeks ago, we live in a culture that is increasingly post-Christian. And depending on where you go, that description's more accurate than in others. But the culture as a whole is heading in that direction. And well, many folks just don't care that much about the Christian faith any longer. If we make much noise, we can be assured we're not going to receive the warm and gracious welcome we might once have received. In light of all this, the whole point of this series of conversations has been to answer the question, so what do we do now? How do we keep chasing God in a world that doesn't give him any meaningful place at the table anymore? Accompanying us along the way has been King Asa of Judah, David's great-great-grandson, and the first king who kind of got the nation back on the right spiritual track after Solomon had led them away from it. The first thing we have to do in this journey is to make sure we are, in fact, heading in the right direction. If we're going to be chasing God, we're going to have to make sure we look like him, both inside and out, that we're pursuing the spiritual disciplines and putting in place the spiritual guardrails we need to stay on track. Pursuing godliness happens both inside and out. It also takes being prepared to wave the white flag of help when the situation gets beyond our ability to handle it. The fact is, that happens more often than we care to admit. When life gets overwhelming, we call on God. But we don't just call on him and sit back on our heels. When he clears our path and shows us the way forward, we actually have to, take it. And that takes a willingness to do the right thing, even when it's hard. That is courage. Chasing God demands courage. We have to remember, though, that sometimes the most courageous thing we can do is to simply pause and take in who God is before we go on. This will leave us refreshed from the stress of the journey. Rest comes when we stop fighting and start following. Now, as you can perhaps see, there are a lot of things we need to do if we're going to successfully pursue God as a goal. But of all the things we have to do, there are a few things, too, that we must not do as well. In fact, there are two of them in particular that are worth our time to unpack. One of these I set before you last week. We can't forget God's faithfulness. If we don't remember that God has been faithful in the past, we'll move forward into our future as if he hasn't been, and making it through whatever we're facing is up to us. This morning, we're going to talk about the other thing. And this one can actually cause us to forget God's faithfulness. It's even more fundamental an error to avoid than what we talked about last week. It's something that each and every one of us faces in ways specifically tuned to the path our journey through life has taken. It grabbed hold of Asa's heart in some ways that were really sad, given what the rest of his story looked like. What is this thing? Rather than just telling you, let me show you. And in order to see this as clearly as we can, let's actually back up a bit to the beginning of Asa's story. Do you remember what happened early on in his life when we talked about a few weeks ago? God sent the prophet Azariah to speak a word of both challenge and encouragement into his life in hopes of setting him on the right track out of the gate. Let's take a quick look at this. The Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded, and he went out to meet Asa and said to him, "Hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. For a long time, Israel was without the true God and without a teaching priest and without law. But when in their distress, they turned to the Lord, the God of Israel, and sought him, he was found by them. In those times, there was no peace to him who went out or to him who came in, for great disturbances afflicted all the inhabitants of the lands. They were broken in pieces. Nation was crushed by nation and city by city, for God troubled them with every sort of distress. But you, take courage. Do not let your hands be weak, for your work shall be rewarded." Now, there's a lot going on here. Azariah gives Asa kind of a review of Israel's history and how troubled and violent it was when they weren't leaning into God for their help. When they were disconnected from truth, they lived out all kinds of different lies. But the biggest thing I want us to see this morning is right there at the beginning of what Azariah says to Asa. He says, "The Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you." Now, as we've said a few times in this series, God was interacting with the people then on the basis of a different mode of operation than he has in place with us through Christ. We can't lose sight of that. This "if you do, then I'll do" pattern is all over the Hebrew Bible, but disappears in the New Covenant. That being said, think about the promise that God makes to Asa here. If you stick with me, I'm going to stick with you. Well, think about what that kind of a promise can do to a person. It can give us a lot of courage, can it? I mean, we've got God on our side. Let's move forward with confidence. Well, that's not quite what God said, was it? He said he was going to be found by Asa as long as Asa sought him. That's somewhat different. But it's really easy to drop that last part, isn't it? I mean, how many times have followers of Jesus done that in the last 2,000 years? Probably way more than we care to count. Rather than appropriating the whole promise, we operate on the basis of the part that sounds the best to us. God is for us, and so we can move forward as if he's for us no matter what. But is he really for us no matter what? I mean, on one level, yeah, God is for us because he created us, and he loves us, and he wants the best for us, but it's not the same thing as a blanket assurance that he's just going to bless everything we want to do. Any good parent knows that. Still, the line of thought can so easily go from "I'm good because God's for me as long as I'm for him" to "I'm good because God's for me" to simply "I'm good." And when we've landed on "I'm good," we don't much like to hear that we may not be after all. Just consider the Catholic Church's response to Martin Luther's observation that they may not have been on the right track in the Middle Ages. It wasn't pretty. Well, over the course of his reign, well, he never exactly left the path of righteousness that Azariah's prophecy set him on here. He did gradually begin to become more comfortable with the notion of God being with him. He developed the kind of confidence that led to his forgetting God in the face of the Israelites' aggressive activities to his north that we talked about last week. And when Hanani offered him the divinely appointed reminder God sent him to offer, Asa wasn't too keen on hearing it. Look at 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 10 with me. Then Asa was angry with the seer and put him in the stocks in prison, for he was in a rage with him because of this prophecy he gave him. And Asa inflicted cruelties upon some of the people at that time. What a mess, right? Asa was one of the good ones. How does he go this route? Because he was infected. Somewhere along the way, he got off the path of chasing God and started chasing himself. This interaction with Hanani didn't so much start a pattern as it exposed one that was already in place. It was a signal that some spiritual mold had grown and was starting to impact his health. But rather than dealing with the problem, he just continued in it. He didn't just throw Hanani in prison, starting a pattern followed by many a leader of the state upon receiving unwelcome news from the church. Now, he turned on the people too, it says. But, and this is important, he didn't necessarily just turn his back on everything he'd stood for thus far in his reign. You know, some kings would hit a snag like this and go full tilt in a direction away from God. It's somewhat to Asa's credit that he didn't, but neither did he continue in this pattern of righteousness with the same eagerness as he had before either. Indeed, listen to how the author narrated the end of his story. The acts of Asa from first to last are written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. And Asa slept with his fathers, dying in the 41st year of his reign. They buried him in the tomb that he had cut for himself in the city of David. They laid him on a bier that had been filled with various kinds of spices prepared by the perfumer's art, and they made a very great fire in his honor. Now, that all sounds pretty smooth, doesn't it? You know, he lived and ruled longer than really all but two other kings of Judah. And in spite of his aggressions towards some of the people there at some point in his reign, they still loved him enough to pay him a pretty high honor in his death. There's no final statement about him not really following through or else reneging on the moral and spiritual reforms he brought to the people that so many other kings got. Everything seems like it's good here. But if you're reading along in your own Bible or maybe paying careful attention to the verse labels up here on the walls, you know there's something we skip there. We skip verse 12. Let me read that one. In the 39th year of his reign, Asa was diseased in his feet, and his disease became severe. Yet even in his disease, he did not seek the Lord, but sought help from physicians. Now, what is this? Why include something like this that amounts to basically an editorial note? Well, because it happened. More than that, though, it tells us something. And no, it doesn't tell us anything about whether or not we should go to the doctor as followers of Jesus. That's not what this is addressing. It tells us that this other thing we must not do if we're going to successfully chase after God in a godless world had grabbed hold of Asa's heart. So what is this other thing? It's pride. Pride had grabbed hold of Asa's heart. Now, you've heard about pride. You know the dangers of pride. Pride cometh before the fall, as the King James puts it. We know pride isn't good. At least we know that in our heads. The reality, though, is that few cultures, including ours, have ever really operated as if that were true. Pride lies at the heart of what we value, and more so all the time. I mean, think about it. Some of our biggest celebrities today reach such status by making videos of themselves and uploading them to YouTube. That's not really a mark of humility. The media tends to give the most attention to the people who promote themselves the loudest. Like them or hate them, the current and former occupants of the White House are both well known for their personal arrogance. Everything we do is geared towards celebrating and rewarding pride as a culture.
yet. Pride is dangerous stuff. It's like that mole we talked about. Think about it. When does mold get started? When there's a lot of water and some warmth? Well, when we go through times of refreshment and plenty in our lives, we start to think, I've got this. Even when those times come by the clear action of God in our lives. And the thing about mold is that it can grow in places where you don't notice it. So does pride. It takes root in places we often overlook. You know, the day-to-day issues that we frankly don't rely on God much for because we feel confident to handle them. But if we don't deal with it, mold will grow and spread. And the other thing about mold is that we generally start noticing the effect it has on our health before we actually identify where it is. It is this very impact that alerts us to its presence. Well, pride isn't often obvious at first. But once it has taken hold in our lives, we start to notice some signs that something's amiss. You know, we'll respond to a person who tries to serve us in some way with arrogance and ingratitude that seems to come suddenly from out of nowhere. And later, when we reflect on the interaction, we can't figure out why we responded the way we did. We decide to really watch our behavior and our responses to the people around us more closely. And things stay quiet for a while. But then the ugliness comes out again. It catches us off guard. Then it happens again. And again. And finally, we realize that we've got a problem. Pride is poisoning our hearts, just like mold poisons our bodies. You can't ignore mold in your house. As soon as it comes in, problems are going to begin. In the same way, you can't ignore pride in your heart. As soon as it comes in, problems are going to begin. When pride comes in, the trouble begins. Now, if we're going to talk about tackling pride, we can approach the issue from a number of different directions, and many of these are pretty common. And most of these aren't really helpful. The fact is, for most folks in this room right now, the odds are that you aren't going to just blow up your life because of some pride issue anytime soon. Now, most of you probably won't ever do that. I mean, sure, some of you probably will, but if you're already nearing that point, what I say here this morning isn't likely to do much to help. Your pride's already done significant damage, and fixing the problem is going to take some major renovation work when you open yourself up to the Holy Spirit. Let him show you all the places that are broken, and then go with him step by step through the process of fixing him. That won't be easy or painless. But let's just address the reality for most of us for a minute. Most of you are church folks. You've been church folks for a long time. And you've mostly been living a church folks kind of lifestyle for most of that time. You've lived a faithful life just like Asa did. You know, if Satan can't get one of us to blow up, if Satan can get one of us to blow up, that's great as far as he's concerned. But, you know, what can be just as good if he can't have our souls? Is to get us on a track to kingdom irrelevance that runs just parallel to kingdom relevance and usefulness. And one of the best tracks to that end is pride. Not the big, flashy pride we often call to mind when we think about it. And indeed, whenever we think very hard about some issue of sin, we quickly picture the most extreme version to make our own dabblings with it seem not quite so bad. But rather a quiet pride that can take over our hearts without us noticing anything's wrong until it's almost too late to do anything about it. With this quiet pride, we don't necessarily stop doing any of the things ostensibly for God that we were before, but we slowly begin to trust more and more of ourselves than him for our day-to-day issues. Then this shift just kind of gradually takes over the big things as well. Folks who reach this place in life may still go to church and even serve in some capacity. That's the real danger here. There are no obvious red flags for anyone to notice, including ourselves. But while we keep doing many of the same things we used to, our heart is less and less in them. Other than the few church activities we do, we function like atheists in the rest of our lives. That's no path to life. It's a path to, well, nothing. Nothing but trouble.
When pride comes in, the trouble begins. But pride can manifest itself in other ways, too, that are just as sneaky. The health hits that mold cause can show up in a number of different ways that all look like they might be caused by something other than mold, such that we explore them first while the real cause continues to grow and worsen unabated. Pride can show up through a refusal to be served or acknowledge a need. But the thing that's so tricky here is that a person with this manifestation of pride doesn't look prideful at all from the outside. This person may be the one who's the most active in serving other people, right? He always gives and never needs. She's unfailingly there when you need her and loves to recognize other people and never needs anything for herself or all her efforts. It's the kind of servant's heart we all wish we had, isn't it? And sometimes it really is a genuine thing. But at least as often, and probably more so, it masks a deeper problem. A heart that says, I don't need. The danger here is this refusal to need other people, often justified with the claim that, well, we don't want to be a burden to anyone else. It can quickly become a refusal to need God. That's where things run off the rails. No, that's too strong. That's where things ease over onto a set of tracks that are nearly perfectly parallel to God's set. Nearly perfectly parallel may seem to run straight and true for a while, but eventually that slight variance is going to grow and become very much more pronounced. When pride comes in, the trouble begins. Another symptom of pride hiding in plain sight is an inability to work with other people or ask for help. We might call this the Lone Ranger syndrome. And as before, to most people, these are folks to whom everyone looks as examples of what we should be doing. You know, they can take a task, any task, and just run with it to a perfect, timely completion. Everyone knows that if you want something done and done well, you let them take it. They can do anything, and they never have to burden anyone else in getting it accomplished. These folks are amazing. And they're often prideful. They often don't want to work with other people because, honestly, they don't think their work's good enough. They're not willing to trust other people because they're convinced they can only really trust themselves. And again, it's so easy for this to hide in plain sight, but folks who are in the grip of this kind of pride either burn out quickly or else create a culture around them that doesn't invest in others in order to elevate their own strengths. Then, when they finally stop doing everything they were doing, they leave behind this enormous hole that no one can fill. And who does that serve? You know, they may be talked about for years because of their value to the organization, but if the organization flounders and fails after they're gone, they weren't really all that good for it, were they? All this trouble from a little pride. When pride comes in, the trouble begins. And there's still other ways pride can show up in our lives. It can manifest itself as vanity and arrogance, we know that. But it can also manifest as insecurity and self-doubt. These often stem from pride, and that they come from a desire to hold fast to a certain image we want to portray, along with a refusal to do anything that might jeopardize it. Pride, it's sneaky stuff. When pride comes in, the trouble begins. And there's really no magic bullet to cure it. If you were looking for one this morning, I'm sorry. It takes daily attention and loving accountability from our brothers and sisters in the faith. And that last part is particularly important. We can't beat pride on our own. When we try and isolate ourselves in order to deal with the problem the way we might with a physical disease, we only allow it to concentrate into something altogether monstrous. We have to be actively involved in intentional community if we want to beat back pride. That said, there are a few things we can do. We can put ourselves before the scriptures on a daily basis. There's nothing like the words of God to give us the kind of pride-killing perspective we need on life and ourselves. We can learn to express needs and receive ministry. And this doesn't mean we become ministry mooches. It means that we learn to lean on the others God has brought into our lives to be strong where we're weak, which is exactly what the body of Christ is supposed to do for itself. Part of loving one another is that sometimes we're the one another. Find a group with whom you can be honest about your struggles and let them help you through those, even as you return the favor. On the other hand, We can get involved in serving folks around us whose situations are worse than our own. There's nothing quite like getting involved in bringing relief and hope to someone else's broken circumstances to remind us that we're not where they are, that we're not where they are because of anything inherent to us, but rather because of the net effect of an abundance of grace, along with a few choices and chances that could have easily gone the other way. To think otherwise sets us up to find ourselves right where they are without even realizing how we got there. When pride comes in, the trouble begins. If you're a follower of Jesus, there's one more thing you can do. You can remember whose you are. You belong to Jesus. Now, why does that matter? Because he embodied the pride-killing humility we need here more thoroughly than anyone else has ever even come close. Jesus, God the Son, the second person of the Trinity, reigned over the world in the glory of his splendor and voluntarily stepped down from his throne in submission to the Father's will in order to leverage all that he had for our benefit so that we might live. He rooted himself in the words of God, which was how he overcame Satan's temptations to self-reliance. He allowed himself to be ministered to by those whom God the Father had equipped to such a task. He served the lowest of the low in his culture, and he ultimately gave up his own life in the most painful way imaginable so that we might live. As he said to the disciples on the night he washed their feet, perhaps the most powerful object lesson in humility ever offered, if he, the one true God and King, could do this, there was no longer a bottom limit in terms of how far we go to serve the people around us, all as a reflection of this demonstration of humility. When pride comes in, the trouble begins. But when we unleash the humility of Christ, life is unleashed. And when life is unleashed, it matters not how far from God the world around us has run. We will be able to stay on the right path and draw others to it with us. If we're going to call ourselves followers of Jesus, this isn't optional. It's fundamental to everything we do and are. Let us be unleashed and run the race worth winning.